I want you to imagine the future in motion where all cars are green, bicycles rule, and public transit is fast, frequent, and fun. It's a world where mobility is sustainable and accessible to everyone, where energy is clean and abundant, renewable and affordable, where communities aren't just smart, they're intelligent and nurturing places to live. So come along and explore that world with me on this EV World Future in Motion podcast.
Hi, this is Bill Moore for EV World, and we're going to talk about the future in motion of air travel. And in this case, we have the CEO of a company over in Britain called Hybrid Air Vehicles, and they are seeking to revive the lighter-than-air vehicle, I guess that's aircraft, whatever you want to call it, interest in that and market for that. So, Tom Grundy, welcome to EV World.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to talk to you.
Well, it's a pleasure having you here. I, being a longtime aviation enthusiast and history buff and things like that, I'm always a very short time pilot, 140 hours on my logbook, and that's about it. So I'm an amateur in this space still, but I've always been intrigued by the whole lighter-than-air vehicle development, and it's had its ups and downs over the year. And your company, HAV, is looking to kind of rebuild that. So I'd like to find out where you see the future of lighter-than-air transportation. Where does that fit into a greener future of the world?
Well, it's a great question, Bill, and it's really right behind what we do here at Hybrid Air Vehicles. And if I just start by explaining what a hybrid air vehicle is.
Please do.
Because it might surprise you to know it's a heavier-than-air aircraft. So what we do at Hybrid Air Vehicles is we combine the best benefits of lighter-than-air, the old airship technology, if you like,
right,
with modern materials, modern design, and modern aerodynamics. And we use that to create an aircraft that's very, very efficient by combining buoyant lift from lifting gas with aerodynamic lift that's generated by the shape of our aircraft, which overall operates like a giant wing. And what that means is we keep lots and lots of the efficiency of a lighter-than-air vehicle whilst actually being slightly heavier than air, which means that when we stop, when we turn the engines off, the aircraft comes down and lands much more like a normal airplane. It operates off any flat surface on the ground, and it opens up a whole range of opportunities for us for very, very efficient flight. If I give you a few examples.
Yes, please.
So the aircraft's got applications in the mobility sector where we can carry people point to point. And I'm talking about 90 person point to point travel over sort of small to medium range distances, maybe 250 to 750 kilometer sort of distances, and do that with a fraction of the fuel burn of other aircraft. In fact, we've got electric engines or electric motors in development for the aircraft that will mean we'll be able to move those people in those mobility applications with 90% reduction in CO2 emissions compared to typical fixed wing aviation.
Right.
So it's a huge step change. And a lot of that comes from the electric engines, but actually a lot of it just comes from the efficient lift that we generate from the platform. We also have applications in communications where we use that same efficiency to fly the aircraft for a very long period of time, almost like a pseudo satellite, but a very big one that can carry a lot more payload or a lot more systems, communication systems. And we also have logistics applications. So because we can land the aircraft anywhere and fly over long ranges, we're a low carbon point-to-point logistics aircraft as well. So huge amount of flexibility, a huge amount of efficiency. We're on a path to all electric, but actually, you know, it's a step-by-step process where we're starting off with hugely efficient applications in those different sectors and moving forward towards an all-electric future.
Okay, well, let's kind of back up and give a little bit of the history of the company here. You know, airship technology has been around for more than 100 years. In fact, it's actually older than, heavier than an air flight. People were, flying, lighter than air, in this case, hot air balloons, back in the late 18th century. So it's kind of been a technology that's been around a while. And of course, I think most of us, we tend to, when we think of lighter than air, we think of things, unfortunately, like the Hindenburg and, you know, the hydrogen gas that it used and things. So what kind of brought about, then of course you came to World War II and you had, you being in, you know, there in Britain, the barrage balloons and that whole phenomenon. What kind of brought, why the resurgence of interest, given, since then you've got, giant aircraft like the 747 and the Airbus 360 and things like that that haul hundreds of people at hundreds of miles an hour. Why the resurgence now?
Well, I think there's several reasons. There's one technological reason, which is that our the modern technology we can bring to bear in this system is in this century is so much different to what we had all those years ago. So some examples of that, I talked about this being a lifting wing shape. We're a lifting wing made out of fabric. Without high technology fabrics that came onto the market sort of 15 years ago, without modern computational fluid dynamics, without modern structural design techniques, without things like fiber optics and fly-by-light technology, this wouldn't be possible in the way that we're doing it today. So the technology base has moved forward so far that we're able to make much more efficient aircraft. And this sort of combination of most of the benefits of lighter than air, of floating rather than having to power the aircraft through the air, most of those efficiency benefits we retain while still having a heavier than air platform. You know, that wasn't really possible back in the time that you're talking about there. As a practical matter, we've moved away from the industry and the sector's moved away from hydrogen and into helium. There's plentiful helium available for these sort of applications, and helium's completely inert. It won't even sustain a flame. Yeah. So those sort of pictures that people remember from the 20s and the 30s, very much a thing of the past. But I think the bigger thing is the need for efficiency. So it's very expensive flying an aeroplane. And a fixed-wing aeroplane. And you talked about Boeing 747. And of course, that's fast. It's very efficient for what it does. It moves people quickly, transatlantic distances. But it's an expensive technology. And it's a technology that we've got used to using fixed-wing aviation and helicopters, rotary-wing aviation for all sorts of different applications. And quite a lot of the time, it's an expensive way to do the job.
Yeah.
And it's not only expensive in financial terms, it's expensive in environmental terms. You're burning a lot of fuel just to keep the empty weight of the aeroplane up in the air, and then more fuel to carry the fuel that you need to carry, and more fuel being burned again to carry the useful bit, the people or the payload. So it's expensive, and it uses a lot of hydrocarbons to do that. And there are a lot of applications where that's just not necessary. If you're looking to fly for long, long periods of time, which lots of applications need, you don't need to be burning fuel at that rate to do that if you use our technology. If you're flying point to point with our technology, you can be doing it at this kind of carbon footprint of a train rather than the carbon footprint of a high-altitude jet aircraft. And so we've seen this in various cycles over the years. You talked about the Second World War, when, of course, there was so much demand for pilots and aircraft and for patrols and all those things. Actually, there was a lot of lighter-than-air technology being used back then because there was that need for efficiency that was driven by the demands of the war. And we're in a similar situation now where actually we can't continue to be burning fuel for everything. And the places where we don't need to, we shouldn't. And by the way, it makes good economic sense as well, because it brings down the price of flying, and it means that aircraft can do more jobs and make money for their operators and provide good services to the people that use them.
Okay. Well, so let's talk a little bit about the technology that in the Airlander. I know I did a little research, and it's a very sophisticated combination of layers of fabric that make, you know, when I think of the old Hindenburg, that was a rigid airship with lots of, you know, aluminum skeleton, and then they covered that with doped fabric, which, of course, only compounded the flammability issues of the thing. You don't, there's no internal structure to this thing, really, sort of, I mean, metal internal structure, other than, I guess, cabling and the way the fabric is stitched together in that, how would you describe that kind of a dual bladder kind of a amoeba that's sort of merging into two? it's really a unique shape, that's for sure.
It is a unique shape, and you know, it looks different to other airplanes, and so it should, because it does a different job in a very different way. So it's all, you know, the primary structure is made of a very, very modern and high-tech fabric, and as you say, it's a composite. It's a composite of three different layers, all combined into one single piece of fabric. One single thickness. It's not actually very thick when you feel it, but it's incredibly strong. So if you think about it as the fabric equivalent of modern composite or carbon fiber structures, you're not too far away. So it's lightweight, very, very strong, and it provides a combination of features for us. It's joined together in such a way that it provides the aerodynamic shape that we need to generate aerodynamic lift. It also provides the properties that allow us to retain lifting gas inside it. And the really cool bit is it provides the structural strength and rigidity that the aircraft needs to fly. So it's a really clever piece of technology that's very, very efficient. It's combined structure, gas barrier, and lifting surface. So that's the fabric. Onto that structure are mounted propulsors or engines, which can either be combustion engines or, as I've said before, we have an electric engine option that we're developing with Collins Aerospace. And so that electric engine will be fittable to the aircraft within 5 years from now. And then underneath the aircraft, you have what people might think of as the gondola. We call it the either the cabin for passengers or the payload module if we're carrying cargo or equipment, and that's primarily, you know, a carbon composite structure at the bottom there.
Okay, so and that shape is how much of the lifting property do you get? I mean, we think of a wing, obviously. This is a big fat wing, it appears to be. So how much of the lifting property do you get?
So typically, because it does vary a bit depending on what you're doing and the phase of flight that you're in, but typically you'd think about 40% of our lift coming from aerodynamics and about 60% of it coming from aerostatic lift or buoyancy. And again, it's all about optimizing for that low fuel burn, that 90% reduction in carbon emissions, versus the practicality of having an aircraft that's heavier than air, so that it's not like the old airships, it's not floating when you're trying to manage it and handle it on the ground.
Right. Yeah. You think of the mooring lines that had to be dropped down and the, you know, the very gases that had to be released, how they controlled the buoyancy back in the day, so to speak. So that's an interesting combination.
That's a big issue, really. It was a big issue for that technology because, you know, the practical job of an aeroplane is to move from point to point and do something useful when it gets there. And if your job is to, you know, take passengers somewhere and the passengers can get off, or to take some tons of cargo and take the tons of cargo off, trying to move things on and off a floating platform is, you know, it requires people and equipment and big masts and things like that. And that takes time.
Yeah.
And so although you'd get huge efficiency when you're in flight actually that was undercut by the efficiency of managing the airplane on the ground. So for us, we've been all about optimizing that to make it easy for the aircraft to do its job when it's on the ground, so that it spends most of its time.
All right, well, let's take us kind of, if you will, I mean, you obviously see, where do you see the predominant market for this? Is it in sort of passenger, aerial safaris, competing with, we have a new generation of electric airplanes. I've interviewed some of the guys building them, that are sort of targeting that same, short to medium haul market. Where do you see your forte being?
So if you take hybrid aircraft as a whole, then really there's four major verticals that we see the aircraft being applied to. Mobility is one. The next one, experiential travel, is almost a subset of mobility, but it's all about going to places that other aircraft can't for eco travel experiences. So that's maybe your safari thought, and also many other parts of the world currently inaccessible that the aircraft can get to. We then have a comms and surveillance application, which really, instead of using our efficiency just to minimize fuel burn and point-to-point travel, that's really all about using our low fuel burn and our efficiency to keep the aircraft flying for very long periods of time.
Right, sort of loitering over an area, for example.
That's right. Perhaps Coast Guard sort of applications, things like that. And then logistics. So going away from places that have got great connections, so going from the port to the inland area that perhaps hasn't got those connections, moving from the railway out into other parts of an area that perhaps aren't so well served. So there you think about remote access, you think about servicing remote communities, servicing mines, working alongside the shipping industry. Now, broadly, over time, about 60% of the market, we think, is actually around that logistics application. And more like 40% around mobility, communications and surveillance, those sort of applications.
Right, which was, from what I read on Wikipedia, you take that for what it's worth, that was kind of the initial design parameter for this when it was, the concept was first proposed to the U.S. military was, something to loiter or, long endurance for, I think it was like 22 days or something like that at 30,000 feet to provide communication platform and surveillance and, I would assume, off the coast of Florida to spot drug runners and, but in fact, there actually is some, I think I remember seeing one particular air balloon over the Keys that I think that was this job was to provide that kind of surveillance. So you kind of moved. That's still an option for this technology, but there may be more practical civilian uses for that as well. Well, let me focus a little bit more on the electric side of this because obviously we're curious. I think as I understand the initial Airlander used four diesel engines to drive. It looked like ducted fans. And I think I saw a press release recently where you were going to some type of a hybrid electric approach, and then obviously the final step would be just get rid of all the carbon spewing engine and just go straight to pure electric. So where do you see that in the state? Now you mentioned what 5 years it would be all electric.
So we've established our vision and our path for this technology is to move to all electric or zero carbon at the earliest possible point. And we're really well placed to do that because all of the elements of efficiency I've talked about, the fact that a lot of our weight is carried by a lifting gas, means that we need less power in the first place to move the aircraft through the air. So our full-size four-engined prototype, which indeed was four full combustion engines, That typically, depending on what sort of flight it was doing, that would typically deliver 75% fuel or carbon reduction compared to alternatives, just even as a pure fuel burning combustion engine aircraft. So we start from that, you know, 75% better through the design. And so the challenge for us then has been, okay, how do we make sure we're bringing the best of what the world of electric propulsion and electric power generation, electric power storage can give us, and get that onto the aircraft as early as possible. So we're running a program here that's UK government grant funded. It's run in partnership with one of our great universities here, the University of Nottingham, and Collins Aerospace. And that's developing electric propulsion at the scale needed for Airlander. And the hybrid configuration, which we've talked about, is effectively keeping two engines as combustion engines and putting two of the electric engines onto the configuration. And so what that does for us is that provides, much the same way that a hybrid electric road vehicle does, it provides us the ability to fly the aircraft on the electric engines and just use the fuel, the combustion engines, for some of the phases of flight. So you're really cutting back on how much you're using the combustion engines, and you're really relying much more on the two electric. But of course, you've got those engines there, the combustion engines there, for extended ranges and for the times and the parts of the flight that you need them. So for us, that's a very, very nice stepping stone. That really, in most applications that we see for that aircraft, that gets you down to really a 90% reduction in fuel burn. So we're going from 75% down to 90% with that configuration. The final step to all electric, well, we're keeping an eye on that, and that's really around maturation of fuel cell technology, potentially some solar, potentially some battery, and just, you know, that's about getting the right amounts of power delivery and storage on board to be able to go that last step to full electric and have an aircraft that's got the range parameters that we really want. So that's the next step for us after the hybrid.
Okay, and that'll happen, well, I guess, as the technology matures. So we have this whole phenomenon of developing what sounds like a flight shaming, you know, where the Prince, for example, Prince Charles, was criticized for, you know, going to meet with Greta Thunberg, you know, traveling 15,000 miles in a private jet and a helicopter, you know, to go meet this young lady who sailed the Atlantic twice on a sailboat, right, to get, yeah, you know, between the two continents. Do you think that's going to play any kind of a role, or is that just sort of a passing phenomenon? Will that eventually be kind of a motivating factor to have, you know, aerial operators, you know, take a look at your technology?
Well, I think it will. I think it will indeed, and is already creating the imperative for people to look at, and the industry to look at, technologies like ours and like many others that provide sensible options to what we've all got used to in passenger transport and logistics and all the other air services that we have. I mean, it's worth saying, I think, Bill, the aviation industry, which I've been part of for over 20 years, it's always taken the need for increased efficiency really seriously. You know, it's deployed extraordinary technology to improve aircraft and improve the efficiency of jet engines, and just to make sort of incremental year-on-year changes. But you know, we don't think it's enough. I don't think it's enough. Because there are technologies like ours that actually approach certain parts of what the aerospace industry does in a very different way. And you can see that from all the things that we've talked about from our configuration onwards. And in those parts, you know, we're not an aeroplane that people are going to jump on and go from, you know, London to Los Angeles in, you know, that's we're slower, we're a different experience, we're there for a different set of applications. But in the things that this aeroplane is designed to do, it can do it, already has done it at 75% CO2 reduction. It'll get to 90% CO2 reduction within 5 years. And you can see the path ahead to adoption of all electric. And there's not much in aerospace right now that's going to get close. Well, I don't think there's anything that's going to get close to that in those sort of timescales at scale. So I don't think that the things that people are concerned about with flying will go away. I do think that people's attitudes are changing, and rightly so. But I think that we need to remember it's carbon that's the enemy here, not flying. Right. And if we get this right, then we can fly without having flight shame. We can do things without having that problem, because as technologists and engineers, we can think our way around these problems and create solutions. They won't always, for every application, look just like a new version of what we've had before. And that's where an aircraft like ours comes in.
Right. You of course, saw Airbus's blended body model that they rolled out here was it a week or so ago, and almost kind of looks like a hybrid between a typical tube, 767, and what you guys are doing. I still think it's going to be jet propelled at this point, but I could see them eventually getting to the point to where it becomes some type of a hybrid configuration as well, using, ducted fans on the rear of the aircraft and things like that. So this whole field is fascinating to watch. Let's just talk briefly here before we wrap up, and thank you for all your time. Let's talk about where you are business model-wise. My understanding is that you were going to retire the original prototype Airlander, and you're looking, I think, to begin series production of some models. So kind of where are we at now?
Yeah, it's a very exciting time for us, Bill. It's we've spent sort of time you need to spend to perfect a new aircraft technology, and that's what we've been doing with the prototype Airlander 10. Flying it, learning about it on the ground and how it ground handles, how it ground operates, and really refining the specification for our production aircraft. You were right a little while ago to say that the first step up to scale here was in a long endurance flying application. There's actually not many people that want to fly for 21 days at a time.
No.
and so one of our jobs has been to really work from where we were with that very, very long endurance aircraft and bring the spec into a place where we've got these multiple applications from one aircraft design, and logistics, mobility, experiential travel, and long endurance flight all coming from one package. So we were really pleased about in January to announce that package, and we put the imagery out and showed people what we've been working on and what the production aeroplane is going to look like, a little bit different to the prototype. And so you're right, we're now working to get the first of those aircraft built and through their type certification program. So for us, it's a job of bringing the great technical expertise that the team has built through flying that prototype, pulling it together with the first customers for the aircraft, and driving through to set up our production line and see many Airlanders flying in the world from 2024, 2025 onwards.
All right, very cool. So you have some customers for it already?
So we have 17 aircraft at the moment under letter of intent.
Good. Great.
So our work at the moment is working with that pool of customers to firm up those first contracts from that group, and they'll be the first people to be flying the aircraft around. Not quite ready to announce who and where just yet, but watch this space.
All right, very good. Now, obviously, the question of helium supply comes up. These are based on helium. Kind of, what's your outlook on what's going there? I read a paper that says that apparently there may be more helium available along the Rocky Mountain Front Ridge and that whole sort of geologic formation there. But that's a little bit speculative at this point. So kind of are you guys going to have enough helium? And what's it cost for helium to, you know, fill one of those things?
So, yeah, a lot of people ask us about that because, of course, people are familiar at various points in time with there not being enough helium to, or not helium supply to sort of fill party balloons and things
right,
like that.
Exactly.
The most visible thing to a lot of us. Actually, most of the use of helium is in other industries. So it's used in supercooling. So that's medical devices, scientific devices. It's used in
chip manufacturing.
In the diving industry, for example. So actually, a fleet of Airlander aircraft at the largest size that our sort of market surveys would suggest would typically be using about 1% of the current annual usage of helium in the world.
Okay.
So we're not actually a big user. In terms of helium availability, the supply issues that people have seen are just that. There have been some supply side issues as different streams of helium come online and go offline over the years. Some of that is to do with a big strategic helium reserve that's over there in the United States, where helium's released onto the world market, and sometimes the rate at which it's released changes, and it takes the supply chain a bit of time to catch up. But the big picture here is there's, according to the US Geological Survey, around about 50 years of known reserves at current usage rates. And so, like the other industrial users of helium, we've not had a problem getting hold of that. We don't anticipate there being not enough helium to do what we need to do in the years to come. And then from a cost perspective, we don't actually consume helium during the use of the airplane.
Right.
So you put the helium in and it stays in. You do end up with a little bit of replenishment and top up that you need to do each year. That's just from sort of natural wastage rather than us actually using it or consuming it. So when you look at how much the helium costs per flying hour of the airplane, it's a very, very small proportion of what it costs to fly what is already a very low cost airplane to fly. It's certainly a tiny fraction of what you'd spend on fuel for other aircraft types.
Right. Okay, so last question. I want to buy one. What's it going to cost me?
It really depends on what you want to do with it, Bill.
Right.
So the way we tend to think of this actually is more about how much does it cost to move something per kilometer, or how much does it cost to fly for a flying hour. So typically, a flying hour cost round about $2,000 to $3,000 a flying hour. To fly an aeroplane like this, and when you think about what it can do, and you think about how much it costs you to buy a seat on a typical aeroplane, that puts that sort of $2,000 to $3,000 a flying hour into perspective. And how can we do that? We do that because we're really efficient.
Right.
So it's very cost effective because it's very efficient and happens to be not burning very much fuel in the process as well.
Right, great. Hey, thank you so much, Tom, for taking the time and talking to us about this really, really exciting technology. I'm intrigued and fascinated, and it appears the world's going to have to slow down a little bit and get used to slowing down and maybe enjoying life instead of rushing around like a bunch of chickens with our heads cut off. So I think this will make an important contribution to doing that. So thank you for what you guys are doing.
Well, we certainly think so. It's a time of great change and a big imperative to change, Bill. We're a part of that and a big part of it in the aerospace world, and it's been great to talk to you about it.
Okay, good. We've had Tom Grundy with us. Tom is the CEO of Hybrid Air Vehicles over in the UK, and we're looking forward to them getting some of their aircraft floating in the air. So thanks, Tom.
Many thanks, Bill.
All right, bye-bye.
You've been listening to an EV World Future in Motion podcast with your host, Bill Moore. Be sure to follow me on Twitter and learn more about the exciting world of electric vehicles on evworld.com. This has been an EV World production, all rights reserved.